Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio, brought to you by your hosts, D.P. Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show on Crime and Science Radio is entitled The Devil's Dozen, What Makes the Bad Guys Tick, with very special guest, Catherine Ramsland. So now here's your host, D.P. Lyle.
Thanks, John, and I want to welcome everyone to the show. As John said, it's titled The Devil's Dozen, What Makes the Bad Guys Tick, and I've been looking forward to this because Catherine is one of my favorite people and a dear friend and always a pleasure to talk with. She teaches forensic psychology and criminal justice at DeSales University, and because she's such an underachiever, she's only published 48 books and over 1,000 articles, and most of them have been devoted to topics in criminology and forensic science, and particularly what makes bad guys tick. And one of her books that's just come out in paperback is called The Devil's Dozen, and it is an outstanding book. As you know, we always put links up after these. They'll be on my website and on the radio at the Suspense Radio website. And you can click on that and learn more about Catherine and her books and a lot of other stuff for further study. But without further ado, I want to welcome Dr. Catherine Ramsland to the show. Catherine, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to being here.
Yeah, I know everybody's going to really enjoy hearing what your insights on all of this. And I know one of your favorite topics, like mine and like most readers of crime fiction and also people who watch the news, are serial killers, because they are such an odd bunch and so far out on the fringes of society. But a lot of people don't really know what constitutes a serial killer. You know, they just think someone who kills a bunch of people is a serial killer. But actually, if you take serial killers, mass murderers, and spree killers, they're actually different animals. Can you tell us a little bit about how you define those and about what makes them different?
Yeah, well, the definitions keep shifting and changing. It
yep.
used to be the FBI had defined serial killer as a person who killed at least three people on three occasions in three locations. However, that would leave out, you know, some killers who bring them back home. And in 2005, they actually changed that to two incidents, at least two victims, two different incidents, and without the cooling off period or anything else, made it very simple, which, again, confuses things. But now, spree killers, they also dropped that out of their vocabulary. However, researchers continue to find it to be a useful category because spree killers are people who kill at least four people, but across a period of time and often across geographical locations. But they're similar to mass murderers who kill four or more people in a single location or loosely related locations in a very tight time frame, and that can be anywhere from, you know, a few minutes to less than 24 hours. Obviously, some killers are, you know, they don't stop and think, which of these do I belong to, which category do I belong to? So sometimes a specific killer can end up being, some people think of him or her as a mass murderer or a spree killer, but typically no mass murderer is ever confused with a serial killer. So there is some confusion in these categories, but for research purposes, they are very different because they usually have different motives. They usually have a whole different approach to the act of murder, the reasons for it, and what happens afterward.
So a spree killer is almost like a mass murderer who's just on the move.
Very much like a mass murderer. Right. Usually they have the same kind of personality. They don't take pains to hide who they are, usually, and it's exactly like a mass murderer, but on the move, drawing it out. They usually are angry. They usually have payback in mind. They usually want to make a statement, something like that. So that's similar to a mass murderer.
Yeah, like Andrew Cunanan, of course, who went all over the United States in a frenzy, and of course ended up with Johnny Versace.
Right.
Do you think Johnny was his target all along?
Hard to. You know? Well, I don't know that he would have had a target if he hadn't ended up in Minnesota the way he did, and then had that disappointment, and that made him really angry, and then he killed the two people there, and then began his spree really at that point. Not sure that any of it would have happened if not for whatever went down in Minnesota.
The trigger.
Yeah. I think Christopher Dorner, that cop who kind of went rogue, I think he's really a classic spree killer because he wrote this angry manifesto. He threatened that this was going to be like a big war that he was going to have, and his killings really took place in a fairly tight time frame, but still spread out. And to my mind, he really represents, I think, a classic spree killer. We knew who he was, we just didn't know where he was. We didn't know how long it was going to last. We could kind of predict what was going to happen. Cunanan is kind of an outlier for spree killers because that really took several months for him to finalize that.
And his anger must have at least abated at some point in time. It just maybe simmered, but, you know.
Yeah, and one of his victims is simply a guy he killed because he wanted his truck.
Exactly. That's a guy in New Jersey or something like that.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. You mentioned the cooling off period, and that's often talked about with serial killers. The psychology of the cooling off period, why is that important, and what is that really about?
Yeah, and I think a better term for that is a de-stressing period,
right?
Because cooling off almost sounds like, they heat up and now they're cooling down and they're back to normal. And that's not really what it is. What happens for a serial killer, and it's not all types of serial killers, it's really the ones who are more or less addicted to what they're doing, and so they tend to escalate and be driven by the tension of that addiction. So they go out sort of looking for victims. They find somebody. They do whatever they're going to do, and some of the tension is alleviated. So it's a de-stressing period, and then they might go dormant for a little while until that addiction begins to build up and pressure them toward going out again,
acting out again. And
yeah.
So the act kind of satisfies whatever's inside them that they need for a variable period of time.
Yeah, and that variable period of time can be, you know, just a few hours in some cases, or it can be a year. So it's really quite variable across different cases.
But to me, that was always one of the interesting things about Dennis Rader, you know, the BTK, that he took such a long time off and almost seemed to reactivate when people forgot about him.
Well, I'm going to just say, since I've talked with him, I kind of don't think he did take a time off, but that's my theory. He did not confess to any murders that would have been during the time when Kansas reinstituted, capital punishment. So let's put it that way.
Okay. So you think he was probably still active during
period? There's some things that indicate the possibility. Obviously, I don't have any evidence or I would turn it over to the police. But what was interesting about Rader is that he wasn't driven by an addiction the way somebody like Bundy, let's say, or Dahmer. He actually set out as a young man to become a serial killer because he had been studying them. He had read his father's detective magazines and whatnot, and he just got it into his head that this is what he wanted to be, which isn't the same thing as a person who just starts killing people and then becomes addicted to it. Now, he really set a frame for himself that he wanted to be known as this kind of a infamous type of an elite serial killer. So when he would go out, like he started with a family of four,
right.
Which was very similar to the Clutter family killings in Kansas also that happened
right.
when he was 15. And then he would go out and kill, and then he'd go dormant again. And you could actually see in his life history, like he was married, and they were trying to have children and couldn't, so he was frustrated, or he'd lose a job or something, and he would go kill someone to kind of re-empower himself. But that addictive quality wasn't actually quite there in his activities, so it actually doesn't surprise me that he could stop when he wanted to and reactivate when he wanted to. And it was actually somebody deciding to do a 30-year retrospective on the crimes that got him going again, because he didn't like someone else in charge of his story.
Interesting.
Yeah.
He did seem like a pretty cold, calculated, methodical guy.
He's very, very much so, not at all driven by sexual need, but more by the need to be known as a serial killer, which is we have a few other cases like that, but it is pretty rare.
And for those of you out there listening who don't recognize the Clutter name, that was, of course, the Dick Hickok, Perry Smith killings
right.
that Capote made famous in Cold Blood. I reread that book about a year ago after having read it many, many years ago. And
yeah,
it holds up just as well now as it did then. Some of the terms that people have trouble deciphering and really understanding what they mean are things like MO versus signature and trophy
mm-hmm.
versus souvenir. Can you talk a little bit about your feelings on those things and what those words really mean?
Yeah, those are really investigative terms for if you have a series of murders that you think might be related, you're trying to do something called linkage analysis. So you're going to be looking at the modus operandi, the manner in which it was committed. What was this person's approach to the victim? How did they get the victim under control? What weapons did they use? What did they do with the body? Is there a dump site? How many crime scenes are actually involved? That's the MO.
The mechanics of murder.
The mechanics, which can change if they decide something's not working right, or they'll change a weapon. I mean, there's a myth out there that serial killers always use the same weapon, which absolutely is not true. I mean, I know so many cases where they just switch it in and out for whatever purpose they need. It's the mechanics of it. And then the signature is more of a psychological term, and in particular for those for whom the murder is satisfying some kind of psychological need. And typically it will express a ritual or a deviance, a paraphilia, which is a deviant sexual pattern, using an object or some kind of experience to be aroused that is considered culturally to be a deviant thing, like a shoe fetish or necrophilia, something like that. So the signature will show us something personal, something about that person. For example, always covering the victim with grass or weeds, or tying them with a certain type of knot that always shows up from victim to victim. We had one in Texas, the Texas eyeball killer, who always excised the eyes so skillfully that they didn't even know the eyes were missing until they got them to the autopsy suite. We had the mad biter, who always liked to bite people in certain ways. There was one signature where the guy always stabbed in a circular manner in the left breast. So that would be something that would really help with linkage analysis, because the MO can change, but the signature tends to stay fairly stable, because it is about expressing something or meeting a need that is something that remains stable within the person, but repetitive.
Yeah, so the old equation that police use and investigators use to track any kind of murder, the how plus why equals who, and the how, of course, would be the MO, and the why would be manifested through the signature, because that's what's personal to them. offender profiling is something obviously that is on, you know, you can't turn on the TV without, you know, every Tom, Dick, and Harry knows how to profile.
Well,
and obviously Silence of the Lambs and
don't.
That whole series did that. What is that really, and
if,
what's it really
if they're
about?
Watching TV, they definitely don't know how to profile.
Exactly.
In
the real world, how does profiling
world.
Work?
Yeah, the whole word profiling has gotten so confused. I mean, it's used in at least five different ways now. A behavioral composite of traits and behaviors has come to be known as a profile. But we have racial profiling, which is like a blueprint against which you measure people to see if they measure up. That's not the kind of behavioral profiling we're talking about for a crime. That's retrospective profiling, where you look at a crime scene or series of crime scenes to interpret behavioral evidence. You know, things like what time of day was this done? What rituals might we see? Did this person leave evidence or take anything with them? How did they meet the victim? So that's all profiling. But if you watch Criminal Minds, you'll see them, you know, like one will come in all grumpy and say, stop profiling me. And by that they mean kinesic interpretation, reading people's body language. That's not really profiling. And then another thing, another way people have used the word profiling is actually threat assessment or risk analysis. That's not profiling either. But I've seen the term profiling used for that. And unfortunately, it's gotten so confused and so, I don't know, so simplified on TV that I really find it hard. I teach a whole class on it, and it becomes very difficult to get students to forget all the myths and oversimplifications out there, and that's really unfortunate.
Yeah, absolutely, and it has gotten to where it's become more woo-woo than science, and it's really,
well,
it's really
not
almost
science.
Common sense and science mixed together.
It's not really science. I mean, that's one thing I said tonight when I was teaching my classes. There has never been any kind of study, controlled study, on profiling to determine the accuracy, to really measure how good it is, whether there's an error rate. There's really no scientific study on profiling, and it is an educated guess based on probabilities and extensive experience, but nevertheless, it is certainly not science. And, it's an educated guess because the profilers are people who spend most of their lives looking at crime scenes. They will know more about MO and signature and whatnot than someone in a local jurisdiction who only sees a homicide, you know, every 5 or 10 years. So someone who's looking at this stuff every single day and is immersed in databases and whatnot certainly is going to have a lot more to say when they're trying to figure out a crime scene than someone with no experience. But nevertheless, it certainly is not a science.
Do, for lack of better terms, even though there are better terms, you know, messy crime scenes versus pristine crime scenes, planned versus unplanned, you know, the old mixed crime scenes and all that they talked about, is that still viable?
Well, people use it just for, you know, I mean, it's a continuum. So you have organized on one end and disorganized on the other, and it's a continuum. If you have a very, very disorganized scene, that's probably the most helpful in this because that's probably somebody who has a pretty serious mental illness, who does not study criminology or whatnot, who probably doesn't realize that they have evidence on them, who probably has some kind of psychotic mental state. So that's actually fairly helpful. But if a person is very organized and very likely predatory, they're going to be probably the hardest type of person to really catch. So typically, if you're looking at an organized versus disorganized kind of polarity, you're going to be hoping for more disorganized because that is actually going to provide many more clues and pieces of evidence than an organized crime scene.
Isn't this type of crime scene analysis, isn't this really what led to the the guys that developed profiling and the national database and all that in the first place?
Well, they were already, it was Howard Teton in the FBI who actually began the profiling unit, and they were evolving, and each of them was, I think there are maybe 6 to 8 agents in the what we call the first generation of profilers. So each of them was trying to find a special area that would become their field of expertise. And a couple of them then developed this organized versus disorganized idea. And for a while, everybody thought it was great, but, it's come under a lot of criticism as being far too simplistic. And the fact is most crime scenes are mixture of organized and disorganized behavior. But that's why I say if you have a very, very disorganized crime scene, then that person's probably been quite careless, probably carried away evidence on them, probably has, a mental health or illness history that you could probably find documented in some institution nearby, some facility nearby. So in a way, it's not a completely useless dichotomy because if you have a disorganized crime scene, there's an awful lot that you can tell from it that could be quite helpful in developing leads.
Well, let's talk a little bit about something else in the same arena as victimology.
Okay.
A lot of people have never even heard that term. Those that have probably don't really understand it, but this fits into this whole gathering of evidence and understanding crime scenes and all of that. Tell us a little bit how victimology works.
Well, all profiling and actually all investigation starts with victimology. You really have to know as much as possible about the victim in order to develop leads that are going to not lead you down a lot of dead ends. So you have to try to figure out what was going on in the victim's life, especially in the hours leading up to this person's disappearance or murder. Who had they talked to anyone? Had they talked about anyone they were frightened of? Who was the last person known to have seen the victim? What were the victim's habits? Were they high-risk victim, low-risk victim, medium-risk victim? In other words, were they doing things like prostitution or drug substance abuse that would have put them into a much more high-risk category, or were they just at home in a lot, behind closed doors and locked doors? Then they're a low-risk victim. So you're looking at every possible angle on the victim and who the victim knew to try to figure out where did the killer and victim cross paths.
Right.
And, where and when and why did this victim get killed? So you start with victimology. I mean, that's one of the real problems when you see some of these movies with profiling. They don't start with the victimology.
Right, exactly.
How are you going to figure out what to do if you don't know anything about the victim?
And the high-risk victims, like particularly the prostitutes that hang out on street corners, they made Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer, made his job very easy.
Absolutely.
Those type of young women, climb into cars with strangers all the time, and how do you mm-hmm. know the next guy isn't Gary Ridgway?
Exactly. And that's why he got away with it for as long as he did with it.
Yeah, forever, it seemed like.
He wasn't that smart of a guy, but he certainly was elusive.
But he knew how to pick his victims.
He did. And to be, in fact, he was so cold-blooded that at one time he actually had his young son in the truck with him, and he was killing him, and he said, well, if he had seen me, I would have just killed him too.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cold.
Yeah. Bundy had two victims at once.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, which you're talking about ballsy.
Yeah, and there's some, it was hard to get the story out of him, and I've talked to Bob Keppel a bit about this. There's some suggestion that he took two so that he could have one watching him kill the other, because that was just one more thing he wanted to try. But I think he hinted at that and then he backed off of it, so there was no way to really know if he did that, but it wouldn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, it's always been one of the things that's puzzled me, at how Bundy is looked as the pretty boy with just a bad habit, and Dahmer has looked at this most vicious guy, but Dahmer was really very sick and knew he was sick.
Yeah.
We're going to jump back into this after a brief break and have more here with Dr. Catherine Ramsland.
Welcome everybody back here after the break on Crime and Science Radio, The Devil's Dozen. A little bit about the bad guy with very special guest, Catherine Ramsland. And again, here's your host, D.P. Lyle.
Yeah, thanks everybody for coming back with us here with Dr. Catherine Ramsland. While we were at the break, we were talking about serial killers and their brains, as Catherine and I often do when we get together, which says something about us, I think. And John actually posed the question to her, do you think, you know, these serial killer types, we should keep them alive and study them, or should we just go ahead and whack them and be done with it? What are your thoughts on that? Can we learn from these people, really?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can learn some things for a while, as long as they think that there's some benefit to them in telling us. But on the other hand, they're also liars. They're adept at manipulation. And the ones that I've studied as in-depth as I possibly can go often just keep their – whatever they want to keep secret, they are going to keep secret. But I also think that we shouldn't just whack them. I think we should take their brains first, because we are actually learning an awful lot from about the structure and function of the brains of some of these individuals, especially the psychopathic ones. That is helping us understand more about how they probably have developed into the kinds of killers they have. And I think if we could get them, and Bundy almost donated his brain to science. He came very close until he got this religious person and he told him not to. And, of course, there was a big fight over Dahmer's brain and whatnot. We do have a few of these guys' brains, but not enough, and I think that's where we'd really learn the most.
Which always reminds me of the famous Stephen King quote. They ask him, how does he come up with all these great stories? And he said, because I have the brain of a small child. It's in a jar on my desk.
Exactly.
But, Kathy, you were also talking to us about how Bundy ended up in Florida. And that's an interesting tale. Tell us about that.
Yeah, he escaped twice in Colorado and was caught once and returned. And then he escaped in a very ingenious way the second time. And that time he managed to get himself to Michigan, where it was winter, so he found out how really cold it is. I'm from Michigan, so I know how, and I'm not there now for that same reason. And then he ended up going to Florida, and there is some speculation that he certainly knew that Florida was a death penalty state. He had asked an attorney in Colorado specifically which states had the death penalty. So weirdly enough, he goes straight to Florida. And now that's not the only warm state to go to if you're going to head out of Michigan. So why choose Florida? I've always wondered if there wasn't some kind of death wish on his part.
Yeah. And, of course, then he went into his spree mode almost down there at the
sorority
house.
He was totally out of control.
It
was because he got angry once, because he had been trying, I think, to dance with this woman, and she had kind of treated him like, you know, who you think you are, and like old man, and he got upset that his techniques hadn't worked on her. And I know he said in one interview that he was walking down the street intent on murdering somebody, and somebody went into the sorority house. He had not targeted that house that night, but it turned his head when he saw that movement, and so he saw the door was open, and he went in on impulse, which is interesting because that was not at all what his typical mode was. And he attacked four girls in that house that night, killing two of them, and went down the street and attacked another woman in her house that same night. And then about a month later, he grabs a 12-year-old off the school grounds in the middle of the day. These are acts not of a careful predator that he had been in the past. And then, to go along with this speculation, someone told me that he could have easily escaped from the jail in which they held him at first, and yet he didn't even try. So these are all behaviors that indicate to me this is a guy who just wanted to bring this to an end.
Maybe he was worn out.
Maybe he's worn out. And he also was having a hard time supporting himself because he was stealing credit cards and whatnot. But it was he was living as cheap as he could, and he wasn't able to get money very easily. So I do think that he probably was feeling quite desperate.
Yeah, and I must plug a book here if you haven't read it. Any of you out there is Ann Rule's The Stranger Beside Me. And
yeah.
She knew Bundy very, very well. Was actually a very good friend of his and you know, was in a crisis center hotline with him and everything. And it's a compelling story as only Ann can write. And she had personal firsthand knowledge of Bundy before we knew about him. And she didn't recognize at all what was going on, which is pretty chilling. And Anne's a pretty sharp, tough cookie. Anybody who knows her knows that.
You know, I recently read everything there is on Bundy because I was writing an article to kind of compare all the different things he said to different people to show the chameleonic nature of him. And it really was interesting to kind of place many of the things he had to say side by side and people's impressions of him side by side to see just how he played people. He was always on.
As the judge said, he probably would have been a good attorney.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, no surprise there, right?
Yeah, I mean, he could. He had a gift for gab, as it were.
Yes, he did.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your book, this wonderful book, The Devil's Dozen, which is an outstanding book.
Thank you.
And I encourage anybody to pick up a copy and read it. The full title is The Devil's Dozen, How Cutting-Edge Forensic Took Down 12 Notorious Serial Killers. And it's well-researched and well-written and just a compelling read. One of them is a case of Robert Pinkton, also known as the Pig Man. And what was interesting about it is it brought in, we were talking about profiling, geographic profiling as part of that case, which I thought was interesting. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the Pinkton case.
That was a pretty tragic case because he probably murdered at least, you know, somewhere in the 60s or more. And this is kind of a real low-life, low-intelligence loser who owned a pig farm, and he would go pick up women, drug addicts and prostitutes, and whatnot, bring them back to the farm and party with them and then slaughter them with his pigs. And then he would, cut them up in the threshing machines and whatnot. Wherever he took the pig parts he couldn't use, he just mixed them up with some of the human parts, and he got away with it for many years. He was a geographical profiler who kept trying to bring law enforcement's attention to, I think you have a serial killer here. All these women are disappearing. Nobody's paying any attention. It was Kim Rossmo, and they basically kind of told him, you have a fanciful imagination, and they just didn't pay attention. And so Pinkton continued to be able to pick these women up because he just wasn't getting investigated. So, yeah, geographical profiling was part of that. But also a great many areas of forensic science came into it because, you know, there were parts of these women in various places all over the property. So they had anthropologists come in, dog handlers, you know, all different kinds. This was a long-running trial that took about a year, and that was only on some of the victims, not even on all of them. So quite an involved process.
It's never just one thing, is it? It's always a bunch of things that have to come together just right, it seems like. Rarely do they have a Perry Mason moment.
And even in this trial, I mean, the best people they had as witnesses were drug addicts who couldn't quite remember. They remembered seeing something that looked like a woman hanging down from a hook, but they weren't really sure. And so, all of the witnesses had these checkered pasts and, you know, were not themselves the greatest people. So it was very difficult. And I remember the jury stayed out for a long time, and people were wondering, oh, my God, what's going to happen?
Yeah, in fact, they weren't sure he was going to even be convicted.
No.
Yeah.
And he didn't really get really the full thrust of the law. A lot of people thought, you know, the jury just didn't bring back the right verdict on him.
Well, everybody knows about you know, DNA and fingerprints and blood spatter. I mean, you know, if you watch CSI, that stuff's everywhere, and almost any of the programs do that. But there's a lot more to forensic science than those biological things and pattern things. We talked about Dennis Rader earlier, a sociopath of the first order, cold-hearted, and we talked about all of that. But his case actually went into computer electronic type data that really spelled the end of this guy.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about how that came about?
Yeah, although actually it was kind of simple. He was pretty careful, but he didn't pay attention to how computers really work. And so when he decided to emerge again, he asked for help on using the church's computer without realizing that he was leaving an imprint on the disk. And he had decided that he was tired of handwriting his notes and whatnot and copying them at the local college, so he was going to use a computer. And he asked he was kind of doing this cat and mouse game with law enforcement by leaving ads and whatnot, and he basically asked them, if I use a computer, can you trace me? And they said, no.
You mean they lied to you?
No, we can't. And then he went ahead and used the computer disk, and that, of course, led them back to the church, the computer that he had used in the church, and they knew that somebody named Dennis had been on that computer, so all they had to do was ask the pastor of that church, is there somebody named Dennis here who might have been using this computer? And the pastor said, yes, as a matter of fact, I showed Dennis Rader, who's the president of our congregation. He was the one on that computer. So then it was a matter of getting the DNA through his daughter's medical records, and
exactly.
That was it.
And that was the end of that story.
Yeah. I mean, I would say how the Devil's Dozen came about, since we're talking about forensic science. I had written a book, which was a history of serial murder, called The Human Predator. And I followed that up with a history of forensic science called Beating the Devil's Game, because when I was doing my research on all the serial killer cases, I came across all these amazing stories of these 19th century forensic scientists who the courts did not want, you know, in their business. So these scientists found ways to get involved with sensational cases to display to the public how important science was to the investigative process. And as a result, we have evolved now to making forensic science pretty much indispensable. And so between the two of those books, I saw these cases where forensic science and serial murder crossed paths in such a way that the serial murder investigation actually changed the course of forensic investigation and sometimes forensic science. In fact, we even have DNA analysis in crimes because of a serial murder case in England. So that was what was exciting to me about writing The Devil's Dozen, was taking these amazing historical accounts of these forensic scientists and that hardly anybody knew about, and showing how they really made forensic science into a very important discipline for law enforcement.
And it still amazes me in this day and age where everyone has, you know, iPhones and computers and Facebook pages and et cetera, these guys still use cell phones and text and emails and all this to communicate with each other like no one knows it's going on. You know, it's, I mean, you might as well put your return address.
Well, and I think people don't understand that, and
right.
Unfortunately they don't.
Fortunately they don't. Yeah.
But they don't seem to get it because everything's so invisible in the digital world. And for a long time, digital criminals did get away with things because
sure.
Law enforcement did not have the training and knowledge to catch up to them. That has obviously changed, but it took a couple of decades before law enforcement realized, you know what, we need to really not only get on top of this, but get ahead of this. So they have now become much more sophisticated, but I tell you, when criminals realized the digital world was such a playground, And nobody knew enough how to stop them.
Sure.
They really went for it, but now, of course, they're leaving their tracks all over the place without realizing how sophisticated the detection equipment is.
Yeah, and we hear more and more about it, you know, from the Craigslist murder on and on. I mean,
yeah.
There's just a digital trail.
Yep. My neighbor is the commander of our digital lab, so I always hear about all the digital stories now.
Yeah.
It's pretty fun.
Well, I'm also fascinated by another area that doesn't get a lot of attention. It has to do with inks and papers and documents and paints and stuff like that. And one of the interesting, I mean, they were all interesting, but one of the really interesting cases in this book was the Lucian Staniak case, the Red Spider Killer.
Yeah.
Tell us about that story. That's wild.
And that was a hard story to get details about because there just so little of the investigation was out there. But real interesting tale of this guy, and also his motives were weird. This guy who was killing women, you know, really in a nasty way, stalking them and killing them, and then writing these letters in red ink as if he was writing with his own blood. It was an odd kind of ink, and it was really difficult to try to figure out where these letters were coming from because they seemed to be, there just was no way to pinpoint exactly where this guy lived. But then they got, you know, a break because I believe it was he killed two sisters. And they managed to track him track one of the victims, so here's victimology, to an art club. And then they realized that it was like a red paint, you know, and that he had actually was painting his aggressions. He was putting these aggressions into his artwork. So, and he was part of this club as well. I'm getting this tale a bit mixed up. But what was interesting about that case, at least to me, was that he had his anger. He wasn't killing women for sexual purposes so much as out of anger that a woman had, I think it was killed his parents, and she had gotten away with it. She had gotten off light. And he was so angry that he began to punish women for this. So that's a pretty rare type of serial killer. Usually you find punitive motives among mass murders and spree killers, but not as much among serial killers, and especially to keep going and to be so elaborate that the way he was with these strange letters he was writing to, like the police stations and whatnot. He'd kind of announce that he's going to kill somebody so interesting case.
Well, in modern times, obviously, one of the more disturbing things that have come along in the years are stalkers, and they come in many flavors and many degrees of psychopathology, of course. If the people out there, a stalker can be anywhere from someone who is just annoying to someone who is downright dangerous. And other than the guy standing on at your door screaming, "I'm going to kill you and your whole family and everybody you ever knew," what are the clues? What are two or three things that if someone is being stalked, that would lead you to believe this is not just someone who is annoying and is a little infatuated to someone who is truly dangerous? Are there any things that they would do or any types of things they would do that would really make this say, "Whoa, wait a minute, I better take this seriously and get some help here"?
Well, most of the stalkers who actually are violent have been in a relationship with a person they're stalking. And so they have this control issue. They don't want that person to have a life of, typically it's a male and a female, a life of her own. So it ends up in violence because they're the ones who are going to have the final say. So more stalkers who are violent tend to be jilted spouses or boyfriends or girlfriends or something like that. But if it's a stranger stalker, first of all, let me just say, never, ever, ever engage a stalker. There is no way to ever rationally convince them that their behavior will lead nowhere, because you're just a pawn in their game. Everything you say is part of the game. It only has meaning in terms of what they make it mean. And they will welcome anything, even being thrown into prison because they stalked you, because it gives them that connection with you. They will welcome any kind of attention. So the best thing to do is give them no attention. But if they are increasingly writing angry things, especially if they're doing drawings that would indicate they want to stab you or shoot you or something like that, those would be some of the items of threat assessment that would indicate a higher risk than if they're just hanging out and kind of trying to bump into you or following your car or something like that. But even so, let me just say, one of the hardest things for psychologists to do is risk assessment, threat assessment, because we really can't tell very much very far into the future how dangerous a person might or might not be. We just don't have a really good way to know that. People can be threatening, but that doesn't mean they'll necessarily ever really act on it. Or they can be perfectly nice and wonderful, and then all of a sudden they shoot you in the middle of the street. So threat assessment is a very difficult. It's the last thing I do in my forensic psychology class, because it is the most difficult thing for psychologists, and also probably the riskiest thing for them to do, to put themselves in the line to say yes or no, this person will be dangerous.
Sure, and it's just a very difficult thing. And I know the question from the victim's point of view is, now what do I do? You know, do I go get a restraining order? Well, sometimes that just is the trigger that sets them off.
That's absolutely
what do you do?
Right.
How do you get out of this mess?
Many victims have moved, you know, left.
Right.
I know I was stalked once and I had to move. It's horrible. It's just an awful, violating feeling of that your life now belongs to them, and that's how they want you to think of it. And it's really quite awful.
So psychologically, it is a control issue mostly.
Well, it's
for them.
Terrorism, really.
Yeah.
It's terrorism.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all about control for them, but they want you to always be aware of them. So it just really is like just like terrorism.
Tough world.
Yeah, and it's quite frightening. I mean, there was one case in Ohio of a guy who got a fixation on this 15-year-old girl who was he was a friend of the family, and he fixated on this young girl, and he just had to kill her. He would write these like 80-page emails with all these threats and whatnot. So finally, they were able to hold him or detain him in a clinic for a while, but you know, he did everything he was supposed to do.
Yep.
And
he was the perfect model.
Kept,
he was a role model, exactly.
He was a role model. But he kept secret these journals that he was obsessively writing, and they didn't even know about that. So they didn't even have the proper data to be able to say whether he was going to be dangerous or not. So when he was released, they were able to say, he's fine now, and they were right. But 3 months later, he shot and killed her.
Scary.
Yeah, it is. Stalkers, that's the hardest thing. It really
is. It
is.
What's next for you? What are you working on now? What can we look forward to down the road? I know it's something down and dirty.
I don't like to say much about
future
things, because I have this superstition that it's an energy leak. If you talk about what you do instead of write about it, you've kind of taken the wind out of your sails in a way. So I try not to talk about what I'm actually working on for the future. I'm putting a lot of effort into the blog that I write for Psychology Today. I do that about twice a week. And in that blog, I take on news stories Pistorius, for example, or Jody Arias or, you know, something. And I talk a lot about the psychological angles on these stories. So I'm having a lot of fun with that in particular, because it's a way for me to constantly stay close to the high-profile crime stories. Or I might talk about, you know, how Dexter inspired somebody to kill his younger brother, the Dexter, the TV show, or,
right.
you know, or brain research on psychopaths. I'll take on anything that has an angle from forensic psychology or forensic science. And I've been really doing a lot with that this past year.
Yeah, and that's a great post that you put up there on the psychology. It's called shadow boxing is the component there, and look for that because I read that stuff all the time and retweet a lot of that stuff.
Yeah,
I really like it.
You should do the one I just put up, the innies and outies. It's how to increase your what I call your OQ, your observational intelligence. And I have a little test whether you're an innie or an outie, and it's a great test for writers, and it's a great test for investigators. I even taught it to a coroner's conference.
Wow, I'll go look it up right now. I'll put a link to that on the website. Once again, I'll remind everybody that they're on my website and on the radio show and the Crime and Science Radio section of Suspense Radio, there will be links and all of this. Go get Catherine's book. She's written a ton of them. They're all wonderfully done and wonderfully researched. The Devil's Dozen is one of the best, but there's many, many good ones. Catherine, this has been great. Always love it. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. I had a blast.
See you guys next time.